This is Sea Change Radio, covering the shift to sustainability. I'm Alex Wise.
I really want to focus on the things that matter. I know that none of us has that much time in this world. We, even if we live to be 80 years old, we only live about 30,000 days. That's not that much. We should be doing what matters. We should be telling the truth. We should be working for what we care about. We should be pulling together to leave a better world for everyone.
Today on Sea Change Radio, we hear from two people who, on separate coasts and in different ways, are pursuing their missions for a more sustainable future. First, I talk with Kincaid Reiling, co-founder of Amyris, a Bay Area biorefining company that hopes its sugar-derived petroleum substitute will, within a few years, offer a competitive, low-emission, sustainable alternative to jet fuel and diesel. Then, Sea Change Radio founder Bill Bowie interviews Bob Massey, a pioneer in the movement toward corporate social responsibility, founder of the Global Reporting Initiative, award-winning author, and now a candidate in Massachusetts for the United States Senate.
Who are these children who scheme and run wild? Who speak with their wings in the way that they smile? What are the secrets they trace in the sky?
My guest on Sea Change Radio is Kincaid Reiling. He's the co-founder of Amyris. It's a biorefining company in Emeryville, California, that's developing fuels and chemicals as petroleum replacements. Kincaid, welcome to Sea Change Radio.
Thank you very much, Alex. It's a pleasure to be here.
In a nutshell, what is Amyris all about?
Amyris is about developing renewable alternatives to the kind of petrochemicals that our society has become dependent upon over the last 50 to 100 years.
In terms of a company right now, where are you and how far away are you from that holy grail of delivering cheap renewable fuel to our vehicles?
We have been in existence since 2003. Our first product actually was an anti-malarial drug, the work funded by the Gates Foundation. And that's looking to go to market in the next 1 to 2 years. So that's to help expand the supply and lower the cost of a needed drug in Africa. The name of that drug is artemisinin. On our renewable fuels side, we've been at that since about 2006. We will go into our first large-scale contract manufacturing site this year, and our first full-scale refinery, which is at a sugar mill, in 2012.
All of your tests are based on sugar. That's your feedstock, so to speak. Can you explain a little bit more about that basic process of taking sugar to getting it to where you can run tests like we just saw here in your lab?
When we say feedstock, what that means for Amyris is something that feeds the yeast that we use to produce the product. So it's kind of very, very similar to how a beer is produced. You take a bio source, be it sucrose or other fermentable sugars, and you add it to a vat, and then the microbes eat that and convert it into the fuel. Where do we get our sugar? Currently, we're looking at sugarcane as a very renewable, low-cost, low environmental impact feedstock. But we have, in addition to that, projects to be able to take cellulosic sugar inputs in the future when they become cost competitive with current feedstocks, being sugarcane.
Can you map out for our listeners, Kincaid, the goal for the distribution of your products in terms of the fleets and how people would ultimately be using your fuel?
We're making something now, it's called a biofeed. It's produced in the fermenters, and it can be then converted on to making diesel, among other products. Of note, we recently announced that we're able to convert that into, and we'll be able to sell, a renewable ingredient for cosmetics called squalane, derived from the same starting point as the diesel. Our timelines for diesel, we're certified for sale up at 35% in the United States by the U.S. EPA. That is actually the highest blend percentage for a single biofuel yet approved by the EPA. We are now going, this year and next year, we'll be working with fleets for large-scale testing so that we get OEM warranty coverage and acceptance by the industry. So we would see fuel sales again, in for these demonstrations in the next 2 years, and then beyond that, expanding our diesel business.
You're also trying to create jet fuel as well, correct?
Yes. In parallel to that, we have a program for jet fuel. The certification process for jet fuel is longer. Thus, we don't see jet fuel in the market until the 2016-2017 period. It takes 4 to 5 years just to get through that certification. And as someone that flies a lot, I'm glad that the certification process is rigorous. But we've developed with the Air Force an excellent jet fuel, biojet fuel, and we're moving forward with testing on that now.
So you don't have any plans to produce non-diesel fuel for vehicles in the future with your current technology, correct?
We have identified a gasoline substitute that we could produce with our technology, and we've actually received a patent on that. We have not announced how that fits into our development timeline. Diesel and jet are our first targets for fuel replacement.
Do you know how many billions or trillions of gallons we use in passenger vehicles and in non-diesel vehicles in the States?
So the United States uses about 140 billion gallons per year of gasoline, and I believe about 20 to 30-ish billion gallons per year of jet fuel, and then the 60-ish around diesel. So quite a bit of fuel. And for perspective, last year, the United States produced on the order of 12 billion gallons of ethanol. So there's a lot of room for growth in the demand for biofuels.
My guest is Kincaid Reiling. He's the co-founder of Amyris. Can we talk a little bit about the technology now? Walk us through the nascent stages of Amyris.
So Amyris is a spinoff of UC Berkeley. Myself and fellow scientists, the co-founders, were working in Jay Kiesling's lab on how to move a very important class of compounds called isoprenoids into microbes to make them at a larger scale. We originally were working in a bacterium called E. coli. We were able to demonstrate that we could make this precursor that went into artemisinin, which is the antimalarial drug. We started the company with that as the initial product and have expanded the platform to include yeast, which the common yeast that is used in beer and making bread. How do we take a yeast organism and enable it to make another product? It's by making modifications, genetic modifications, that turn off the ability to make ethanol and turn on the ability to make our products. Our first product, for instance, was found in apple peels. So it's taking a product already found in nature and just getting a new format for it being to be produced, that being a large biorefinery via fermentation.
What do people say? And if I can't make it through tomorrow, I better make it through today. To listen to Sea Change Radio anytime, anyplace, just subscribe to our free podcast. Simply follow the link from seachangeradio.com or search for us in the iTunes podcast directory.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio. My guest is Kincaid Reiling. He's the co-founder of Amyris. It's a biorefining company that's developing fuels and chemicals as petroleum replacements. So a few minutes before we spoke, Kincaid, you took me around Amyris's labs here in Emeryville, California, and you showed me the shakers and the beakers and how the robots can stack things. So you've come quite a ways from developing your first compounds out of apple peels. Why don't you talk about the technology today and what you can share with us?
So it first starts with identifying what product we want to make. In the instance of the diesel fuel, for instance, we wanted to make a product that was a drop-in replacement, that was it was indistinguishable other than its renewable qualities from the product, the existing petroleum product. You mentioned apple peels. We identified a molecule that was found in apple peels. We take those genes out of that, put it into an existing yeast organism in this instance that is widely used to produce ethanol today. We turn off the ethanol genes. We turn on this, making this compound farnesene. That organism is then placed in a fermenter, a large vessel that has sugar added to it. The yeast is allowed to grow. It eats the sugar, converts it into our product. Our product actually is pure hydrocarbon, so that when it's in the fermenter, it actually separates out like salad dressing oil from water. So it's very easy to get out of the production fermenter. We then take the oil, the renewable oil. It's purified and then converted onto chemically into our various products. So the product coming out of the fermenter can be hydrogenated into a diesel, or it can be through other chemical transformations into lubricants, surfactants, and other renewable products. And that general path of identify a drop-in replacement, update the yeast software to be able to produce the product, grow in fermentation, purify, and then take to market will be generally applicable to all of our different products.
So you mentioned updating the software. Can you expand on that?
Of course, software is a metaphor here, but the yeast has a genetic code, which is basically instructions for how it grows, replicates, does all the things that it needs to do to live and reproduce. That ends up being a huge metabolic map, many different genes, many different products turning on and off. When we go in and update, what we'll do is change some of the genes, change some of the instructions, and effectively that alters the execution of the genetic code for the yeast. So it is going in and making targeted modifications such that to the genes, such that the metabolic web of the yeast produces diesel versus beer.
Listeners who hear this always want to say, well, this is great, but when am I going to be able to actually put your end result into my car? Where do you realistically think you are from that day?
When will consumers in the Bay Area have access to our renewable diesel? Unfortunately, I can't pick a date today. I'd like to, but what I will say is that over the next 2 years, we'll get full warranty coverage and acceptance. And as we're able to scale up production between now and 2020, hopefully we'll have it in the Bay Area very soon.
Have you gotten to a point where you've produced fuel for test vehicles, though?
Oh, definitely. We've tested. So our local Emeryville has a Emery Go Round, which is a free shuttle. We've run over a month-long programs with them where they drove around with the product. The good news from that is that the driver didn't notice any difference, which is the point of a drop-in fuel that we're developing.
And let's talk about the emissions. Are they negligible or are they similar to a diesel?
So we've seen, and this is both in laboratory testing and on-road testing, a reduction in emissions. Our product is very pure and therefore does not have some of the contaminants in traditional diesel that cause NOx emissions, SOx emissions, particulate emissions. So actually the product burns cleaner than traditional diesel and will reduce emissions. We've seen up to 10-15% reduction for some of those different classes.
And do you hope that this fuel will be cheaper than traditional gasoline that people put into their car, or is it you're hoping that it's more sustainable and that it's also gets us off of digging holes in the ground constantly?
It'll be cost competitive with petroleum, and it will have obviously lower overall greenhouse gas emissions, and we're aggressively ensuring that our fuel is produced in a sustainable way. So it should have all three of those benefits: sustainability, lower greenhouse gas emissions, and cost competitive.
Can you tell us about what measures your company's making to ensure that it's as sustainable as possible?
Sugarcane is generally considered as one of the most sustainable crops for production of biofuels. Secondly, the regions in which that we're doing production are hundreds of miles away from the rainforest. So for our first site, it is roughly the same distance Florida is from New York as our site is from the Amazon. So there is quite a bit of distance between. There is no chance of our site encroaching upon on the rainforests. And then as far as for sustainability, we're aggressively looking at the various sustainability frameworks that are out there for ensuring that our fuels are produced sustainably. Our first site that we're looking at, San Martino, has actually certified with some of the early sustainability frameworks.
And is the sugar grown using petroleum-based fertilizer?
Actually, in Brazil, fertilizer use is very minimal, and they actually will take the output from the fermentation and recycle it by putting it back on the field. So they'll use the vinasse, which is kind of the leftovers after a fermentation, to recycle the field. So effectively, you're putting back into the field what you took out of it in the first round of growth. So they're very, very efficient with their need for fertilizer.
Kincaid Reiling, the co-founder of Amyris, thanks so much for being my guest on Sea Change Radio.
All right, Alex, thank you very much, and thank you to your listeners.
Follow the shift to sustainability with Sea Change Radio on Twitter at twitter.com/SeaChangeRadio and on our Facebook page.
Next on Sea Change Radio, Bill Bowie interviews Bob Massey, a leading voice in the environmental movement who's trying to become the next U.S. Senator from Massachusetts.
Bob Massey, thanks so much for joining us here on Sea Change Radio.
Delighted to be here.
Now, Bob, you probably the most significant thing that you've done in your long career of a lot of significant things is build a global coalition of folks in corporate sustainability and even beyond around reporting. It's called the Global Reporting Initiative, and it's a framework for companies and other organizations to report their sustainability impacts. Can you tell us a little bit about what the significance of this is for your political work? How can you apply this? And first off, what is it? What is GRI?
Well, we're seeing all over the world that people are looking towards how to create a completely new idea about our economy and about prosperity. It's not just about financial capital. It's also about natural capital, human capital, intellectual capital, and bringing all those things together to make it possible for communities and nations to thrive. Now, when you ask a company, how are you doing on all of those areas, it's very hard for managers and for others to answer. And if you ask investors, are you investing in companies that are doing well in these different areas, it was hard for people to answer. So we pulled together an international group from all different sectors, from NGO groups, from government, from the UN, from accounting societies, from businesses, and from all different countries, from Europe and Brazil and Japan and Australia and US, Canada, and asked them to work together over a period of years to design a tool that would be helpful to everyone, to the businesses who want to measure their impacts, the investors who want to understand them, and to the activists who want to hold companies accountable for their behavior.
Where has your experience, for example, running the coalition, the non-governmental organization or NGO series, what kind of skills does that bring to you in terms of managing a transition in our economy through some very difficult times and need for that the bold vision for the future?
Well, I have an interesting background. I started off in social justice issues and worked as a minister in New York City on homelessness. I've been interested in racial discrimination. I worked on environmental questions. And yet I also got training at Harvard Business School so I could understand the nature of prosperity and the nature of poverty. And when I was at Ceres, I ran the largest coalition of public pension funds and institutional investors with environmental groups and others who came together and said, we're in this for the long run. We want our economy to thrive over the long run. We need our beneficiaries to benefit in the long run. And how are we going to do that? how are we going to sit down with companies and industries and ask them not to take the short-term perspective of how to extract the most profit in a short amount of time, perhaps by breaking apart industries or communities, but thinking about really building. And fortunately, there are many leaders who are willing to consider that, not all. So to answer your question, the whole challenge of building a new economy depends on different parties from society being able to identify what they really want, express that to each other, and then work for a common goal. And frankly, I think that the Congress is often far behind, where many Americans are, and certainly where many people in the world are. People come to the United States and listen to our political debates and say, this sounds like something from 25 or 30 years ago. It is not where people want to go in this country or across the world.
Yeah, and that particularly applies to the realm of sustainability, environmental concerns. We've got a Senate and Congress that has refused to set a price on carbon, which is seen as the mechanism that will help bring our carbon emissions down. So in that realm, what do you see breaking this deadlock and moving our Senate and government leaders forward?
Well, in the end, it's going to have to continue to be, as it's always been, citizen leadership. We have to put pressure on Congress and on the government to recognize what's happening all around the world. I just read today in the newspaper that coffee in Central America is becoming in short supply. Crops are down to 70 or 60%, so people are not able to make a living. And all the people who drink coffees and love Central American coffee are suddenly freaking out because the price goes up. Well, this is because of climate problems. And that's a tiny indicator of things that are going all over the world. So we have to continue to focus on the science. As one columnist pointed out, right now we're acting like someone who takes their child to an emergency room, 60 doctors are lined up, 58 of them say this child has appendicitis, we have to operate immediately. Two of them say, I think maybe she just has a bellyache, and we go with the two. That's dangerous, it's stupid, it doesn't make sense, and certainly it's something we have to avoid in the future. We have to take bold steps. It is not only in our interest of survival of our species, which you would think would be enough, but it's also necessary for our economy, even in the medium term, because many other countries are seizing this opportunity to transform themselves, and we're sitting looking out the rearview mirror as though this is all we need to do.
So embracing sustainability is actually good to combat the negatives, but it's also got a positive path forward economically as well.
Absolutely. I mean, if you think about where we were 30 years ago, and if someone had said to you the entire economy is going to be changed by information technology, we might have speculated that was crazy. But we now see what an immense transformation actually took place, and we're really only at the beginning of it, what smart systems can do to reduce our energy use, to transform the way we receive information and so forth. We're just at the beginning of that. We can either seize that moment and create a beautiful new society with clean cities and with new information technology and energy technology, with new medical care, or we can sit back and watch other people innovate around the world. 11,000 miles of high-speed trains are being built in China right now. 400 solar plants in China right now. German and European companies all over building new technologies. We are arguing about whether it's really necessary. It's a good idea. The rest of the world is happy for us to be locked up in these old-fashioned arguments, because they're going to blow by the United States while we're sitting here arguing about the past.
Well, and speaking of the past, you have a very interesting personal story that brings you to where you've been. Can you share with us some of the most important parts of your past that really inform your commitment to leadership in the political realm?
Well, people can probably hear a bit of passion in my voice, and that's partly because when I was born, I had a serious illness called hemophilia, which affects your joints. You get swellings in your joints. I wasn't able to walk for most of my childhood. I wasn't able to go to school. I had leg braces. I had wheelchair. I was always afraid of losing my medical care. People were sometimes frightened of my appearance because of the leg braces. So I think it built a very early sense of identification with people who, in a sense, are seen as on the margin of society. I went on to a very privileged life. I received scholarships to the best schools in the United States. I've had opportunities and wonderful friends. And I have gone on to survive several serious bouts with bloodborne viruses, including HIV and hepatitis. And I had a liver transplant, which completely restored my energy and actually cured the hemophilia I was born with. So I've seen some miracles in my own life. I have seen some amazing consequences of medical technology. And all of this has given me a perspective that I really want to focus on the things that matter. I know that none of us has that much time in this world. We, even if we live to be 80 years old, we only live about 30,000 days. That's not that much. We should be doing what matters. We should be telling the truth. We should be working for what we care about. We should be pulling together to leave a better world for everyone.
Bob, you wrote a book called Loosing the Bonds that was about the history of apartheid and particularly the relationship between South Africa and the United States. Tell us a little bit about that research, that book, and also the bearing that it has on your political beliefs and aspirations.
Well, I became interested in South Africa as a student in college when my university had a lot of investments in companies that were directly benefiting from the racist regime in South Africa and the way in which it denied political and economic rights. I began to explore that in greater depth, and I returned to it as a graduate student. I wrote a dissertation about it. But for me, it became an incredible story of commitment to a vision of a democratic future against all odds. It was a struggle for the people of South Africa, of not just Africans, but of all different backgrounds, to try to redefine themselves and their history. And so one of the things that I learned, first of all, is what a role the United States had. I got to write chapters, for example, about John F. Kennedy's policy towards South Africa, which was very interesting and complex, about Robert Kennedy's famous visit in 1966 when he gave the best speech of his life, of Teddy Kennedy's relentless view. So running in Massachusetts within the Kennedy tradition, I feel very powerfully connected to how much they led on this issue. But the other thing I learned was people were constantly saying individual action doesn't really add up to create change. Go ahead, sell your stock, do this, protest, or in South Africa, stand up for what you believe in, risk your job. It's not going to make any difference. Any realist can see that. But tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands, millions, tens of millions of people finally said, no, I'm going to make my gesture. I'm going to take my action. And those actions accumulated to an enormous force and eventually forced the South African government to reconsider its entire policy and enabled a transition to a non-racial democracy. I also learned that when people are excited about democracy, they can set aside huge difficulties that they've had in the past and really build a new vision of how they want to work together. It was amazing to watch. I was there in 1993. I was an observer at the elections, and I saw how people chose not bitterness, not hatred, not violence, but a future built on peace and a sense that they could all live together. It was an amazing thing. I think we still have a lot to learn from stories like that that have unfolded here in the U.S., in South Africa, and now all over the world.
Well, Bob Massey, thank you so much for joining us here on Sea Change Radio.
I appreciate the opportunity. Thank you.
Sway the future to the past and find what will endure.
You've been listening to Sea Change Radio. Our intro music is by Sanford Lewis, and our outro music is by Alex Wise.
Additional music by Steely Dan, Eric Clapton, and John Coltrane.
Sea Change Radio is made possible by support from Sungevity Home Solar Specialists and Incredible Adventures, an eco-friendly outdoor travel company. Go to incadventures.com to learn more. Check out our website at seachangeradio.com. That's seachangeradio.com to stream or download the show or subscribe to our podcast. Visit our archives there to hear from Bill McKibben, Van Jones, Paul Hawken, and many others. And tune in to Sea Change Radio next week as we continue making connections for sustainability. For Sea Change Radio, I'm Alex Wise.